Investors Chronicle.
Welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Lauren Almeida, and today I'm really excited to be joined by Azim Azhar, an award-winning tech writer, entrepreneur, and investor. Azim produces Exponential View, which is a newsletter and podcast series that studies the impact of tech on our economy, society, and environment. We talk about his theory of an exponential curve in technological development and the gap that it's creating in the market, as well as our political and social institutions.
First of all, thank you very much for coming on to the podcast. It's great to speak to you and specifically about your new book, Exponential. It's really fascinating. You know, my takeaway was kind of that I think it's somewhat inherent for people to kind of pine for simpler days, even if they weren't so different to the present. But in the book, you kind of argue that change is happening so fast because technological development is on an exponential curve, and maybe people are right to feel a bit dizzy about the whole process. But I suppose a good place to start is if maybe you could explain your theory on the exponential curve in tech.
Yeah, absolutely. No, thank you. And it's really exciting to be on the podcast. I've listened to a few episodes, and I do feel sometimes you've got such great experts on the show. So I'm going to do my best to rise to the level of your previous guests as well. You know, I think that the central idea behind the book is that we are moving into a new phase of economic and social and political organization that is being fundamentally catalyzed by the rate of change of technology development. And that new phase has this hallmark that as the technologies develop really quickly, and I call them exponential rates, they create potentials that move faster than human institutions, like our laws, like our companies, like our politics, can adapt. And that creates what I call the exponential gap, which is the thing that is common between the tensions that we sometimes see around technology and what we might call the real world, right? Why are we struggling with fake news and misinformation and disinformation, but we're equally struggling with the power of the world's largest technology companies? We're also worried about the future of the work. And my point is, this isn't a coincidence. This is a manifestation of the exponential gap, the fact that finally the rate of change of technology development has far outstripped the rate with which our current institutions are capable of adapting to it.
Focusing kind of the tech and how it developed, mm-hmm. I think our readers will be familiar with kind of following the tech industry and applying Moore's law to how quickly chips develop. But I found it interesting that you kind of argue that, well, first of all, Moore's law maybe isn't a tech law, it's more of a social law, and maybe why Wright's law is actually, if you could explain what that is
No, absolutely. So yeah, we're all familiar with Moore's law, and we've lived off its you know, its generosity for 50 years. The idea that computer chips essentially double in power for the same price of pound or dollar every couple of years. And it's interest rates that as investors we could only have fantasized about. 45% compounded annualized interest rate is essentially what you get with a silicon chip and have done for 50 or so years. And I argue that it's not just in computation that we're seeing technologies that are improving at exponential rates, by which I mean more than 10% compounded improvement on price performance basis every year for decades. I mean, that is that the trigger, and any investor knows that you compound interest is the most powerful force in the universe, and a 10% rate is really crazy. It means that you double every 7 years. Now, I identify three drivers for why technologies are now at a point, an exponential point. The first of those three, and we can dig into the other two later, but the first of those three is this idea that we learn by doing. Ultimately, we get better at the second loaf of sourdough bread we make at home during lockdown. We're even better at the fourth. We're even better when we make the eighth. Every doubling of production, we learn how to be more efficient with the mixer and the rise and the use of the flour and making less mess in the kitchen. And this is as true in industrial products. And this relationship, which is the idea of a learning rate with every cumulative doubling of production, is actually something we've known about since the 1930s, because an engineer called Theodore Wright looked at the cost of making airplanes in back in 1936. And he discovered that the per unit cost, independent of any kind of improvement in scale, because you can buy equipment more cheaply and so on, the per unit cost of an airframe declined at about 10 to 15% for every doubling of production. And that was because of increased knowledge by the different types of people who are coming together to build the airframe. And that relationship held true for cars as well. Ultimately, it gives rise to this thing called the learning curve or the experience curve. And that is really fundamentally at the heart of why technologies find themselves on a particular exponential curve. But it's not true for every technology. It's true for certain types of technologies, but it happens to be true for a set of very, very wide ranging general purpose technologies that define the exponential age.
Turning to companies, looking at the exponential curve, we're talking about exponential growth in tech. It's hard not to think of companies like Amazon or Apple, mm-hmm. Facebook, Microsoft, and you know, a lot of these companies, their share price also kind of mimics the exponential curve. I was wondering, do you view these companies as beneficiaries of natural processes like Wright's law, or do you think of them as drivers of exponential growth as well?
Well, that's a really great question. The economy is a complex system, which means that it's got lots of independent parts to it with feedback loops. And so if you think about Wright's law, which predicts semiconductor performance better than Moore's law, for example, it's related to the volume of production. So as a company like Apple, well, the reason Apple can shift a smartphone in like the iPhone in the first place, which it did, you know, more than 10 years ago, was because of the cumulative learning that meant chips were cheap enough to put them in small devices. Mm-hmm. And once they were cheap enough to put them in small devices, more and more people could buy them. And so more people did buy them, which increased the demand for them, which pushed us further down that learning curve. So there is a positive feedback loop that means that, of course, these companies are beneficiaries of the core technologies, but they are also driving the innovation that drives down cost. And in fact, that really takes us to the other two drivers of the exponential age, the things that are making these technologies exponential. You know, the first is Wright's law, which is learning. The second is the idea of standardization and combination. So as the technologies become more and more mature, we've ended up standardizing them, which means that the chip that used to live in your graphics card of your computer is now used by people in artificial intelligence research. The fact that we have standard data interfaces, which means that if there's a breakthrough in bioinformatics databases, that can be applied to the big data for Internet of Things in a completely different sector. The fact that one of the reasons we have such low-cost satellites at the moment is we standardized on a thing called a nanosat, but the nanosats were able to take advantage of breakthroughs in semiconductors in other parts of the industry, nothing to do with the space industry. And that idea of standardization and combination is one reason, another reason why these technologies find themselves on this fast accelerating curve. But the third reason is that we have these networks now of both of information, the internet being a great example, the fact that because we can share breakthroughs very quickly, positive experiences can be copied rapidly across industry. You know, you discover that a retailer in France has come up with some new marketing technique, it's written about, and then a car company in America can go off and duplicate it. I mean, just sort of in extremis as examples. And that's where where we think about someone like Apple, when they first launched the iPhone, they launched it in one store. When they launched the iPhone 12, they launched it in about 300 different cities around the world, because the global network allows them to ship physical products to lots and lots of markets, which then accelerates the rate with which they can sell these devices, which means they can then invest more in R&D the next time round, which means they're going through the learning curve again. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, they are both the beneficiaries and the drivers of it.
And it's interesting, that point about standardization being a key reason why these companies have been able to grow at such rates. I think interoperability as well, and standardization of how consumers kind of access these companies' products, is perhaps a lack of standardization was why they've gotten so big, because they sort of create these walled gardens, yeah, specific universes, but makes it very difficult for consumers to switch. And again, that feeds into the exponential gap between antitrust law and competition law and how big these companies are.
Yeah, I mean, it's really it's such an important point that you've made there. So, of course, you know, the internet was the ultimate interoperable system. I mean, it was the first system that was designed to be as interoperable as anything. I mean, it is a network of networks. That's what internet stands for. It's a sort of this meta thing that sits between a set of different networks. And the only reason it works is because there are protocols that explain why, when I send you an email, my server knows how to talk to your server and no money changes hands. And that has been the sort of foundational basis for the multi-trillion dollars worth of value creation that has taken place in the traditional IT tech industry. What of course has happened has been that it started a bit further back, but really about 10 years ago, the large networks, Google and Amazon and Facebook, started to recognize the importance of creating essentially domains of their own that they could exploit. So people forget that up until about 2011 or 2012, you could reasonably freely access the Facebook newsfeed without using the Facebook web app, or you could use what's called an API. You could just connect to it and you could look at the content that was on there. And the reason that companies stopped doing that, and it was Facebook and it was LinkedIn and then it was others, is that they didn't want their customers easily being able to move from one network to another. Now, if you're in the UK, you'll remember a world where you couldn't carry your mobile phone number when you left, you know, Vodafone to go to what was then called O2. You had to give up your phone number and get a new phone number. And what ended up happening was a regulator mandated something called number portability. There was a time when you know, anyone over the age of 40 will remember this. You could only send SMS messages to people who were on the same operator as you. And the reason was not technical. The reason was this kind of mean-spirited commercial thinking, which was essentially to say, I will encourage you to get your friends on my network, mm-hmm, if you could only SMS them. And then again, when they were forced to open up and interoperate, the SMS traffic per user in the UK exploded. And it was very, very good news for the operators, because it was one of their highest margin products. Of course, then, you know, different forces came into play and SMS got bundled and then it got replaced by WhatsApp and so on. But mm-hmm, the point was, interoperability grew the market. Now, what has happened in the technology industry largely has been a sense of enclosure of your customer, mm-hmm, base. So if you are on Facebook, you can't move off Facebook without losing the ability to connect with all the people you were connected with on Facebook. Mm-hmm. If you're a driver on Uber, you can't go to a rival network and take with you your Uber rating and, mm-hmm, everything that you've accumulated to that rival network. It's as if you went to, you know, you went to university and the university said, well, we've got relationships with these three employers and your graduate degree is only recognized by them. And if you decide you want to go somewhere else, you know, we're not going to give you any credit for it. I mean, so it's a slight absurdity. So I think one of the things that I recommend in the book is to say that, you know, interoperability is a very, very powerful way of closing down these walled gardens. I say it's kryptonite to the network effects of these walled gardens. It's undesirable for them in the short term because it has some technical cost, and it means customers could easily leave if they decide they don't like using, you know, whichever service it is. They could pick up with their preferences and still, you know, retain access to their friends. But what we've seen in the past is that interoperability has actually grown markets and made them larger and made them more efficient and released kind of consumer welfare. So, I mean, for me, it's something that we should campaign for and ask the competition authorities to look at more heavily, because it creates a more dynamic market.
Yeah. And why do you think it is that that companies so far have resisted? I mean, if there is this precedent of, for example, the phone market and that increasing the size of the market and also consumer welfare more generally, why do you think that, that these companies have kind of resisted this concept of interoperability? Or is Silicon Valley just mean-spirited?
Well, I don't think Silicon Valley is mean-spirited, because there are lots of examples of highly open platforms and services that come out of Silicon Valley, and you know, the core technology protocols, many of them are like that. It's more that for a handful of these companies, it's a short-term competitive advantage, and short-term by which I mean you've been able to build Facebook, which is a multi-hundred billion dollar business, as a result of closing off access to the network. So they'll give you lots of arguments. They'll say, I mean, I spoke with Nick Clegg, who's the head of PR at Facebook, a few weeks ago, and he said, look, interoperability, you know, roughly you can see why it's attractive, but technically it's very difficult to do. But I don't think it's a technical difficulty that was the issue. I think the issue was people recognize that the network effect, which is essentially that, you know, the more people who join my product, make the more valuable it is for all the other people who use the product. And that's certainly the case for communications networks. They recognize that the network effect, which was the source of their value, was also the way they could create a moat, a sort of a traditional economic moat around their business. And so they came up with arguments as to why they were going to essentially reduce the amount of interoperability. And those arguments were historically things like, you know, the one that Twitter used was, well, if anyone can access the stream of tweets through any kind of application, not the official Twitter app, they might not get a good customer experience because some shonky third party developer might have written a rubbishy app. And that was the argument. But it's not a real argument. I mean, the real argument is that you wanted control of the network, you wanted control of the advertising channel, and you didn't want customers to be able to leave you because the source of your economic advantage was this moat built by the network effect. So I think now these networks are big. It will be expensive for them to implement interoperability. But let's face it, I mean, they're pretty profitable businesses. And it's hard to believe it's going to cost, you know, all of their profit to build that those capabilities. So you know I think it's something that's really important. I think it's really important because if you believe the general idea that in an economy that has a small number of very, very powerful companies is less dynamic than an economy that has, you know, more vibrant sectors, and if you believe that a society that has a small number of extremely powerful, unaccountable entities, whether those are companies or governments or, you know, anything else, churches, if you think those are not desirable, then finding ways of reducing the inherent power of these very large companies, whether it's for economic reasons or other reasons, is an imperative. And I think that we mostly agree that large amounts of unchecked power are generally unhelpful, and they're kind of unhelpful for investors as well.
I found it really interesting as well, you kind of reference the political context in which these companies were able to grow to the size that they are. I mean, you write kind of from the late 70s onwards, it was free market capitalism that could unleash the power of exponential tech. looking at antitrust and competition law scene at the moment, it seems as though there might potentially be breakups on the way or kind of laws that would limit the power of these big companies. I mean, if these kind of big tech companies are reined in or in some way broken up, does that risk kind of flattening the exponential curve?
It's a really good question. I mean, the historical context is really important because in the 70s there was this bonfire of regulation. You know, you start with Milton Friedman, you go to Robert Bork, and you get into all of this being implemented not just by Reagan, but sort of more broadly, you know, deep in the American government, and it happened at a slightly odd time, because it happened at a time when the nature of competition was changing, because you were getting these companies that I describe as exponential age companies. They don't look like your traditional industry, linear industries, mm-hmm. That we saw, you know, in the past. So the timing was a little bit, it was funny. You sort of sent the fire engine home, you know, just as the arsonist showed up, as it were. And it has resulted in some of these issues where the companies now have argued that it's through us that these benefits are delivered, and exclusively through us that these benefits of technological advancement are delivered. But the thing that I think we've started to see is that if you see how these large companies have behaved, they have hired really, really extensively. There's been a brain drain from academia to, you know, the Googles and the Facebooks and the Amazons of this world. And that comes at a cost, because what the research shows is that when science moves from being in the academe into the corporation, it becomes very, very narrow, narrowly focused on a corporation's own goals and objectives, and time horizons start to shorten. Now, that said, if you look at a Google or if you look at an Amazon, these companies invest in R&D in ways that traditional firms simply do not, into the multi-billions of dollars a year. I mean, I looked at, I think it was Tesco, and Tesco had an R&D lab in 2016, budget of a few hundred thousand pounds, or they said into the six figures, right? Whereas Amazon was spending tens of billions of dollars. And, you know, there are breakthroughs in robotics and quantum computing and semiconductors and self-driving cars and long-term clean renewable energy storage that are coming out of Google. So yes, these companies do incredible commercialization, R&D, and so on. However, the we have to bear in mind two other things. You know, the first is that the longer term data that independent academics have reviewed tends to show that once research gets tied to commercial goals in this way, it tends to narrow in scope, and many of the things that we are benefiting from today, whether it is mRNA vaccines or semiconductors, actually emerged from research that had much longer term scope. And the second thing is just coming back to that question of power and of scale. Do you really want to have a can you really have an accountable and dynamic economy if every service is somehow routed through five or six very, very large companies that are you know, possibly, you know, owned and governed elsewhere? And I think that that's problematic as well.
I suppose from an investor perspective, everyone wants to get in on a technology before everyone else realizes that it's actually amazing and going to change the world. Is it possible to kind of identify an exponential technology, or one that's on an exponential trajectory, before it really takes off, but before it's kind of known outside of the industry that's creating it?
That's a really, really great question. The time it takes for something interesting to exist and people discovering it is shortening, because there's more awareness and there are more tools to help people track these technologies. I think for a traditional investor, the problem you have is that it's a really specialist role. It's the job of the venture capitalist to figure that out. And they are the ones who are trawling the university labs and trying to understand these technologies. So if you look at, there's been a spate this year of companies going public in the intersection between biology and computing. So this is a really exciting area. You know, we've been able to come up with more theory in biology, well, you know, beyond just the idea of the gene. And we've been able to then apply engineering methods and the benefits of Moore's law to a more quantitative approach to this. And so the consequence has not just been things like these RNA-based vaccines. It's been new types of methods of creating materials using genetically modified organisms. There's been drug discovery as well. There's been a lot of activity in the sort of SPAC world taking these companies public. But if you look at when they were spotted by investors, it was really a decade ago. Mm. Now, the question is all of the upside taken at the point at which a venture capitalist invests? And the answer is, well, no, absolutely not. You know, when, you know, Ginkgo Bio, which is doing a multi-billion dollar SPAC or may have done by the time the podcast comes out, the first investment round would have been in the matter of a few million. Now, a traditional investor can't get access to that early risk easily because the best deep tech funds are heavily oversubscribed, and you need to be a foundation to get into them, and you need to be able to write $1 million or $5 million check. So it's pretty hard. So then I think the question is, well, where do you end up playing? And there are now more and more ETFs that allow you to do that. I mean, there's obviously the big one in all of this is ARK, Cathie Wood's platform, which, you know, she and I spoke 3 or 4 years ago on my podcast, and her argument was, there's still a ton of sort of return available in public innovation because the markets are undervaluing it. And that was her argument. And, you know, her funds did very well for the 3 years after that. And, of course, there's been the sort of market turn against tech earlier this year. But there are ETFs, and there are increasingly ETFs that are more specialist and trying to get you exposure to these emerging themes, you know, like in space or in 3D printing or in future of food, which I think retail investors and small scale investors can get access to. But I think that the problem that you then have on that front is you actually have to dig a layer below those ETFs to say, what are you actually buying? So, I mean, I looked at, you know, one recently that was a sort of sustainable a future of food ETF. So the whole idea behind future of food is that it's meat, you know, it's alternative meats, it's plant-based proteins, it is, you know, regenerative agriculture. And when you actually look at the universe of public stocks they can back, it's a lot of it happens to be big food companies, mm-hmm. because you actually just don't have the availability. So as a smaller, more retail investor, I think it's harder. You may have to just wait for these themes to get bigger. But the other question then is, what mechanism do you look for? And one of the critical things about exponential technologies is that it's their rate of growth, or the rate of growth of the rate of growth, that is interesting, not the absolute level. And so the big distinction between a kind of public markets investor and a private markets investor, in my sort of really naive way of looking at this, is that a public market investor has to, sort of goes off and looks at the actuality, and they say, well, you know, are revenues at 5 billion or not? Mm-hmm. Whereas a venture investor will go and say, you know, are revenues growing at 25% per month, even if they're only at $1 million a month? Right, a tiny number, and you're looking at the growth rate. And I think you can start to spot these things. You know, you can spot these things around, say, for example, vegetarian food. The number of people who claim to be vegetarian today is multiples higher than it was in 2016. It may still be a tiny market, but it's been a 5x or a 4x or a 6x improvement in 4 or 5 years, and you don't see that in other markets. So the thing that I look for is I look for early signals of really, really discontinuous growth. And do we think that those things can progress? So when I looked at lithium ion batteries 4 or 5 years ago and their connection to electric vehicles, what the analysts of that field were telling me was that there's a 17 to 18% compounded decline in price every year. Mm-hmm. And you only have to look at that and say, well, that means the price is essentially going to halve every, 3 or 4 years. And that's pretty powerful. So those are the types of things that I look for. But then the question is, can you actually get exposure to them as a retail investor? And I'm not necessarily sure you'll find it that easy.
I also wanted to ask, kind of the flip side of exponential growth from an investor perspective. It's incredibly exciting to look at trends like biotech and food and stuff like that. But there's also the flip side of kind of the destabilizing effects of exponential tech and growth. And I was just interested to kind of hear your view on, for example, like energy and manufacturing, solar energy and 3D printers and that kind of giving, perhaps taking away the traditional power of some states and some institutions that, kind of traditional positions in the global norm and in trade. What do you think that means for companies, big companies like Aramco or Shell or big manufacturing companies that kind of have that benefit of scale, but without the gravity that affects the likes of Facebook and Apple? How can you tell which ones will be able to survive in that period of change?
To give you a flavor of just how destabilizing it could be, solar power is so evenly distributed around the world. So the sunniest country in the world gets 4 times as much sun as the least sunny, which is not the UK, by the way, it's Norway. But in oil distribution, the most oil-rich country has 1 million times more oil than the least oil-rich country. And so when the shift comes, it'll come quite vigorously. I mean, I think betting against a particular technology trend doesn't really make that much sense, but there are also other factors in play. So we've just had the Saudis say they're going to extract every last molecule of oil. And that in and of itself is could be something they do. And if the oil price goes up, it's something they might be able to afford to do. But then you get companies like, the Spanish company Iberdrola, which is, transitioning across to being a renewables company very, very effectively. And I think it's becoming increasingly clear that oil companies may have significant roles to play in carbon capture and sequestration because they know how to, run these big sort of infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So I think what you then have to figure out is which of these companies have actually got credible stories when it comes to making that transition and credible management, and how realistically are they making it? I mean, I personally don't really buy that they have a clear story about how they manage that transition. I mean, I think in 20 or 30 or 40 years time, the oil companies will make their money from pushing carbon into the ground. Mm-hmm. And that's what they'll do. The carbon that they put into the atmosphere, they will suck out of the atmosphere and stick it back into these wells. And that will be their business because they're good at it. The question is as from an investor perspective is, does one have, what do you think is going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years with these companies? Mm-hmm. And what does that transition actually end up looking like? My own view is that the rate with which oil and gas will start to look like some kind of sort of horrible lurgy will speed up. It'll speed up because the climate effects that we've seen today, it'll speed up because of the generational effects, it'll speed up because the technologies are getting, the technologies that replace them are getting so much more mature. It'll speed up because I'm yet to meet someone who's driven an electric car who ever says, I really want to go back to my petrol car. Mm-hmm. Because of that, I think that their cultural transition needs to happen much, much faster than they potentially realize. And so And then finally, you know, global finance has really, really woken up. I mean, it started with the reinsurers about 15 years ago, starting to think about climate risk. And now, you know, you have central bankers and others. I'm not talking about ESG on in of itself. I'm saying they're pricing climate risk in to businesses. And so that means your cost of capital is going up, and that's actually going to impact your bottom line. So I find it a really hard balance to figure out. I personally avoid that old world group of companies because I think they have quite a messy stage to walk through. But then there are clear examples of firms that have done quite well out of this. As I said, I pull out Iberdrola as an example.
I suppose that the growth rates are really interesting to look at and incredibly enticing. But I suppose there are some black sheep and maybe some trends that call themselves exponential, or maybe people call them exponential. Are there any trends that you're dubious about actually, it's whether or not it's actually on exponential trajectory?
One of the things that I wanted to do was try to explain the mechanisms to readers about both the mechanisms of the underlying technology and then the mechanisms of how the technologies turn into the products that we know, and why it's even possible that the products can grow as quickly as they can. And the reason I did that is for exactly the point that you've just made, which is that anyone can say this is the next best greatest thing, and if this is going exponential, this is going to the moon, or this is going vertical. Mm-hmm. And that the test needs to be can we bring it back to understand exactly why or why not that is the case. And it's easier in some cases than it is in others. I mean, during the course of between putting the proposal together, writing the first draft of the book, and now that when the book comes out, TikTok went from not existing to suddenly showing up and being quite fast growing to then being the US government's enemy number one, mm-hmm. to in the last week after the book's gone to press, becoming the first app outside of Facebook to be downloaded by 3 billion people. And so you see these things appear from nowhere. And yet you also get things that show up and disappear very, very quickly. And the way what you have to do is you have to figure out, is this a kind of a market risk question, which TikTok really is, right? So TikTok success or failure was really going to be about whether the consumers in the market took to it and stuck with it. And they did with TikTok. They did less so with this audio social network called Clubhouse, which is out of the US. Is it to do with the product, or is it to do with the core technology, and can we see a path through? And that's a very different set of risks towards that idea of exponentiality. So when I look at some of the core technologies, for example, compute, do I think that businesses will be able to get hold of more and more computation at these exponentially increasing rates over the coming 5, 10, 15 years? Yes, I do. And I come up with a very, very clear rationale as to why that is. Could I claim with any certainty that X app or Y app or A product or B product is going to say take the same trajectory? No, I couldn't, because we don't really know why people buy products and why they stick with apps when they get started.
I suppose that more discerning view towards exponential growth is helpful for investors rather than just being enticed. And sometimes there is a risk of being enticed by really high percentages and not looking much beyond that. But that's really helpful. But it's really been great having you on. Great discussion. Thank you very much for coming on again.
No, it's my pleasure. And if they're looking for the book, you can just find it at the URL exponential-book.com. That's exponential-book.com, and then you can kind of click through to the right link from there for whatever flavor you like.
Yeah, brilliant, lovely, and definitely would recommend the book to anyone who's interested. So great read, really, richly sourced, and it's brilliant.
Thank you, Lauren.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.